So we've had 2 days of fairly grim paintings of history and where we are now and everything in between. And this last panel is going to feature three people speaking about things that we can do now to move beyond the threat of nuclear extinction. So we have David Krieger, Tim Wright, and of course Helen Caldicott. We're going to start with David Krieger. He's the founder of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and has served as president of the foundation since 1982. He has lectured throughout the United States, Europe, and Asia on issues of peace, security, international law, and the abolition of nuclear weapons. He's been involved in many coalitions and networks on nuclear issues, including Abolition 2000, the International Network of Engineers and Scientists for Global Responsibility, Middle Powers Initiative, and the World Future Council. And today he's going to be talking about the Nuclear Zero lawsuits, a bold challenge to the 9 nuclear-armed nations.
Thank you, Ray. And a big thank you to Helen Caldicott for bringing us together for 2 days of 2 days of amazing discussions. This is very important, what's happened here. It's very important that we focus attention on extinction. It's such a difficult concept and yet so critical to our goal of achieving the abolition of nuclear weapons. I want to make a few comments about extinction, and then I'll talk about the heroic Marshall Islanders. Extinction is a harsh and unforgiving word, a word that should make us shiver. Time moves inexorably in one direction only, and when extinction is complete, there are no further chances for revival. Extinction is a void, a black hole, from which return is forever foreclosed. Forever foreclosed. That's extinction. I want to quote Jonathan Schell, who was a great writer and a great abolitionist. And Jonathan said, "We prepare for our extinction in order to assure our survival. We prepare for our extinction in order to assure our survival." So what he's talking about there is deterrence. Deterrence is the way we prepare for extinction. It's a strategy that rests on unfounded, unproven, and the unprovable conviction that deployment of nuclear weapons, including those on hair trigger alert, will protect their possessors from nuclear attack. It rests on the further naive beliefs that nothing will go awry and that humans will be able to indefinitely control the monstrous weapons they have created without incident or accident, without miscalculation or intentional malevolence. In truth, these are beliefs. They're just beliefs without any solid basis in fact. They are tenuously based on a foundation of faith as opposed to provable reality. They are a conjuring of a nuclear priesthood in collaboration with pliable politicians and corporate profiteers. They are seemingly intent on providing a final omnicidal demonstration of Hannah Arendt's words, "the banality of evil." Nuclear strategists and ordinary people rarely consider the mythology that sustains nuclear deterrence, which is built upon a foundation of rationality. In other words, deterrence assumes rationality of all parties. But, and I've often asked this question, can anybody imagine that all political leaders will act rationally at all times, under all circumstances. I think it would be quite irrational to think so. In nuclear deterrence strategies, there are vast unknowns and unknown possibilities. Our behaviors and those of our nuclear-armed opponents are not always knowable. We must expect the unexpected, but we cannot know in advance in what forms it will present itself. This means that we cannot be prepared for every eventuality. We do know, however, that nuclear weapons and human fallibility are a most dangerous mix. I want to refer to some figures by my colleague John Scales Avery in Denmark, who looked at the possibility of catastrophic use of nuclear weapons and what that would mean for human survival. If he took a finite chance of nuclear catastrophe and set it at 2% a year, which seems within the bounds of reason, then in a century the chance of survival would be 13.5%. 2% a year chance of catastrophe, at the end of 100 years, 13.5% chance of survival. At the end of 200 years, 1.8% chance of survival, 300 years, 0.25% chance of survival, 400 years, 0.034% chance of survival. So over a long period, the chances of survival are not good if we continue with the status quo reliant upon nuclear deterrence. Here's what we do know. First, nuclear weapons are capable of causing nuclear extinction. Second, 9 countries possess these weapons and rely upon them for their national security. Third, these 9 countries are continuing to modernize their nuclear arsenals. We might ask 2 questions. What kind of national security is it to rely upon weapons capable of causing human extinction? And put another way, how can any nation be secure when nuclear weapons threaten all humanity? I think those 2 questions are at the heart of the fallacy of the nuclear weapons labs, our politicians, our corporations, our military that support nuclear deterrence. Now let me shift to victims. There have been many victims of the nuclear age, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors and those who died in those bombings, those who were at the nuclear test sites and downwind from the nuclear test sites. All are victims of the nuclear age, and there are many more classes of victims. Holly Barker gave some important statistics and comments on the Marshall Islanders, who certainly qualify as extreme victims of the nuclear age. I want to underline a couple things that Holly said, because I think that they are so important. First, the United States began nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands in 1946. We were the only country, the United States was the only country that possessed nuclear weapons at that time. So really, we went to the Marshall Islands to test our weapons, engaged in a nuclear arms race with only ourselves at the time. Over a 12-year period, we conducted 67 nuclear tests in the atmosphere and the waters of Marshall Islands. It was the equivalent of 1.6 Hiroshima bombs daily for 12 years. Today is Bikini Day, the day of the most powerful U.S. nuclear test that ever took place. It took place on the island of Bikini, March 1st, 1954, so today is the 61st anniversary of that tragedy for the Marshall Islands. Now let me talk about victims as heroes. I think The Marshall Islanders have been a great example of heroes in the nuclear age. They've fought for their own, for themselves, for their own, to be taken care of, not to be abused, not to be treated like second-class citizens, which they were by the United States, or third or fourth or fifth-class citizens. And actually, the Marshall Islands have done something incredibly heroic, in my opinion, and that is file nuclear lawsuits against all 9 nuclear-armed states at the International Court of Justice in The Hague and against the United States independently in the U.S. The Marshall Islands is the only country that's taken that action, that's actually filed lawsuits. And it's important to tell you, they are not seeking compensation in these lawsuits. They're seeking to have the nuclear-armed states do what is right. They're seeking to have the courts enforce Article 6 provisions of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and of customary international law for those nuclear-armed countries that are not parties to the NPT. So let me tell you about the current status of the cases. First of all, none of the countries that were sued really are very excited about going and engaging on a level playing field with the small country of the Marshall Islands, the small Pacific Island country. None of them want to talk about what they've done. They don't want to talk about what's required of them under Article 6 of the NPT, and customary international law. They don't want to talk about their breaches of what's required of them, and they don't want the courts to have any say in whether they'll fulfill their obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and customary international law. So on April 24th, 2014, the Marshall Islands filed these lawsuits. Not long after that, in the U.S. case, the United States filed a motion to dismiss the case on grounds of jurisdiction. In other words, the U.S. didn't want to go to the merits of the case. They wanted to try and throw the case out of court on jurisdictional grounds. And recently, on February 3rd, the judge, who was a Bush II-appointed judge, granted the U.S. motion to dismiss. The Marshall Islands, however, are not deterred by this court decision, and they intend to appeal it. They think it's an unfortunate decision. Grounds of the decision were standing, and in relation to standing, the judge said the injuries to the Marshall Islands are speculative. So in other words, what he seems to be saying to other parties of the NPT and the rest of the world is, wait till there's a nuclear war, then you may have a case. Then your damages may no longer be speculative. And the other thing that he said was that it fell under the political question doctrine, and the political question doctrine says that the executive or the Congress, the political branches of government, should be responsible for foreign policy decisions, that sort of thing, not the courts. But in fact, the executive has been handling this since the Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed in 1968, and in which the United States and the other parties to the treaty with nuclear arms committed themselves to ending the nuclear arms race at an early date and to nuclear disarmament. And so for more than 40 years, they have done, since the treaty entered into force in 1970, it's now 2015, it's been 45 years, and the executive has not done what it should do. So the Marshall Islands are tough, they're powerful, they're not quitters, they're sticking with this, and what's really important is that they are. And at the International Court of Justice, only 3 of the 9 countries have compulsory jurisdiction. Those are Pakistan, India, and the United Kingdom. Those countries are engaged in the cases right now. The other six countries, they have to accept the Marshall Islands invitation to join the lawsuit. They have not done that. Only one country of them has replied. That's China, saying that they will not accept the court's jurisdiction. But the other five countries that do not accept compulsory jurisdiction have just been silent on the matter. Now, let me say something about the legal aspects of these lawsuits. They are about whether treaties matter. They are about whether the most powerful nations are to be bound by the same rules as the rest of the international community. They are about whether a treaty can stand up with only half the bargain fulfilled. They are about who gets to decide if treaty obligations are being met. Do all parties stand on equal footing, or do the most powerful have rules specially for them? They are also about the strength of customary international law to bind nations to civilized behavior. But they're also about more than the law. They're about leadership, boldness, courage, justice, wisdom, and ultimately about survival. Let me say just a word about each of these. Leadership. The Marshall Islands, a country of 70,000 people, is taking leadership on climate change and nuclear weapons abolition, trying to force the powerful countries to do what they should do. Boldness. I know I have for a very long time wanted to see some boldness taking place among nations of the world on the promises and obligations of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Marshall Islands have stepped up boldly to demand that in a court of justice. Courage. The Marshall Islands are small, as I said, but powerful. It takes a lot of courage to do what they've done. Justice. The law should always be about justice, and that's what the Marshall Islands are demanding. Wisdom. We so badly need wisdom these days to confront the hubris, this extreme arrogance of the nuclear weapons states and other powerful nation, and the dream and survival. It's about survival, and the Marshall Islands are at the cutting edge of both of those issues. So the dream should not be a dream only of the Marshall Islands, but our dream as well. It must become our collective dream. I'm very proud to be associated with the Marshall Islands and its extraordinary Foreign Minister, Tony de Broome, who's taken a leadership role in these cases. As a consultant to the Marshall Islands, the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation has organized legal teams at both the ICJ and in the US cases. We have a consortium now of 75 civil society organizations working to help the Marshall Islands. If you're part of a civil society group that would like to take part or to sign a petition in support of the Marshall Islands, please go to nuclearzero.org. You'll find out much more about the cases at nuclearzero.org. Now I want to finish by reading a poem that I wrote recently. And if there's time, two short quotations. The poem is called Testing Nuclear Weapons in the Marshall Islands. The islands were alive with the red-orange fire of sunset splashed on a billowy sky. The islanders lived simple lives close to the edge of the ocean planet, reaching out to infinity. The days were bright and the nights were calm in this happy archipelago until the colonizers came. These were sequentially the Spanish, Germans, Japanese, and then, worst of all, the United States. The U.S. came as trustee, bearing its new bombs, eager to test them in this beautiful barefoot Eden. The islanders were trusting, even when the bombs began exploding and the white ash fell like snow. The children played in the ash as it floated down on them, covering them in poison. The rest is a tale of loss and suffering by the islanders, of madness by the people of the bomb. And the two quotations I want to leave you with are these. The first by Viktor Frankl, who said, "Since Auschwitz, we know what man is capable of, and since Hiroshima, we know what is at stake." The second is by Eric Fromm. "For the first time in history, the physical survival of the human race depends on a radical change of the human heart." And that's what we need. That's the way, that's the direction in which the Marshall Islanders are leading us. It's what we need ourselves, and we need to put that radical change of the human heart into action, change the world, save the world, make it a better place for all of our children, grandchildren, and all future generations to follow. Thank you.
Thanks very much, David. And sorry, I forgot to put poet in your biography at the beginning when I read that out. Our next speaker is Tim Wright. Tim works for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. He's usually based in Australia, but he's here in New York to do advocacy and other work ahead of the NPT review conference this May. And he's one of ICAN's most effective campaigners. He strikes fear into the hearts of diplomats from many countries. ICAN's a growing dynamic campaign that currently has 424 partner organizations in 95 countries. It's global. It's not just North America and Western Europe. It is all over the world, and it's growing every day. It's revitalized international work on nuclear weapons by calling for a treaty to ban nuclear weapons, and Tim's going to talk about that now.
Thanks, Ray. Do I look fearsome? Like most of you here today, I come from a country that has experienced and continues to endure the devastating consequences of nuclear weapons. The cancer deaths, birth defects, cultures destroyed, food sources poisoned, Indigenous communities forever displaced from their sacred lands. I learned of all this in the late 1990s when I read Helen Caldicott's autobiography, A Desperate Passion. I learned of the misery that the British and Australian governments had knowingly and with little care or concern unleashed on our people, particularly our Indigenous people, whom they saw as expendable, powerless, less than human. The atmospheric nuclear tests in Australia and the hundreds of plutonium experiments that accompanied them dispersed radiation across much of our vast continent. No one has ever apologised for this, and the suffering continues. This is my motivation for speaking out against nuclear weapons. Sue Coleman Hasseldine, a nuclear test survivor of the Kakathamulla Aboriginal Nation, a woman of extraordinary strength and courage, left Australia for the first time last year to speak at the Vienna Conference on the Humanitarian Impact of Nuclear Weapons. To an audience of over 1,000 people, including diplomats representing 156 nations, she said, "If you love your own children and care for the children of the world, you will find the courage to stand up and say enough, always keeping in mind that the future forever belongs to the next generation." This too is Helen's message, and I thank her for bringing us together this weekend, for awakening me to the possibility of nuclear extinction, and for everything that she has done over so many years to end the nuclear madness. I only wish... I only wish that I were nearly as energetic and youthful as she is. In 2007, with Helen's help, we launched the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, in an effort to reignite the languishing global anti-nuclear movement, to get better organised and to finish the work of decades past. It was an ambitious undertaking, no doubt, but we felt confident then and feel confident now that it is a battle that we will ultimately win. Indeed, in many ways, we are already winning. That might seem a naive claim in light of all we have heard this weekend about the perilous state of the planet and the many barriers to nuclear disarmament, not least of all the bolstering of existing arsenals. But there are glimmers of hope, and I do believe that we will abolish nuclear weapons before they abolish us. Helen asked me to end on an upbeat note, so that I will do. Over the past few years, we have seen the start of a fundamental shift in the way that governments talk about nuclear weapons. Not the governments of nuclear-armed nations or their nuclear weapon-loving allies who remain firmly stuck in Cold War thinking, but the rest, the other 100 or more members of the family of nations constituting the overwhelming majority. Possessing the bomb, it is worth remembering, is not normal. Almost every nation in the world has made a legal undertaking never to acquire nuclear weapons. But for many years, these nations have taken a back seat in disarmament debates, waiting patiently, idly, hoping that the promise of Prague and every other promise would be realised, but no longer. The so-called humanitarian initiative on nuclear weapons has emerged because of mounting frustration at the failure of nuclear-armed nations to fulfil their decades-old disarmament commitments under the NPT. It has emerged out of recognition that simply bemoaning their inaction, no matter how loudly, is not an effective strategy for achieving abolition. Indeed, why would we expect the nuclear-armed states to lead us to a nuclear weapon-free world? Why would they willingly, happily give up weapons that they hold so dear, that they perceive as the ultimate guarantor of their security, that they believe give them prestige and status in international affairs? Meeting as we are at the Academy of Medicine, it is perhaps appropriate to draw an analogy with the banning of smoking in public places. And I do apologise to the smokers here because it's not a very nice comparison. We would never expect the smoking community to initiate and lead efforts to impose such a ban. In fact, we would expect them stridently to resist it. The non-smoking community, the majority, who wish to live and work in a healthy environment, must be the driving force. That should be obvious. Similarly, it is the non-nuclear weapon states on whom we must depend to drive a process to ban nuclear weapons, to stigmatise them, to make them socially and politically unacceptable, to make it harder for nations to get away with possessing and upgrading them, and to help the nuclear weapon states overcome this awful, debilitating addiction. This flips the traditional arms control approach on its head. The humanitarian initiative is about empowering and mobilising the rest of the world to say enough. It is about shifting the debate from acceptable, safe numbers of nuclear warheads to their fundamental inhumanity and incompatibility with basic standards of civilised behaviour. It is about taking away from the nuclear-armed states the power to dictate the terms of the debate and to set the agenda, and refusing to perpetuate their exceptionalism. I want to show you now some footage from the first two conferences as part of this initiative, which have involved governments, ICANN, the International Red Cross movement and various UN agencies. They took place in Norway in March 2013 and Mexico in February 2014, with 128 and 146 nations participating respectively. And this is a clip from our message to the third conference held in Vienna last year. As Ray mentioned in this morning's session, the Austrian government concluded the Vienna conference with an extraordinary and very exciting pledge to work with all relevant stakeholders, including civil society, to fill the legal gap for the prohibition and elimination of nuclear weapons. And ICAN is now calling for negotiations on a treaty banning nuclear weapons to begin this year. This is not a radical proposal. Indiscriminate, inhumane weapons do get banned. Indeed, nuclear weapons are the only weapons of mass destruction not yet subject to a comprehensive global prohibition. In the 1990s, a small group of humanitarian-minded nations, with the active encouragement of civil society, decided to initiate a diplomatic process to outlaw anti-personnel mines. They began by assembling the irrefutable evidence of the catastrophic impact that these pernicious devices have on people. That, they knew, would provide a solid foundation for successful negotiations. And it is what we now see in the nuclear sphere, the groundwork carefully being laid. Of course, many of the major users and producers of landmines stubbornly refused to participate in negotiations for the mine ban treaty. They claimed that such weapons were fundamental to their security. US allies such as Australia worked actively to undermine the process, proposing gaping loopholes and voicing scepticism at every opportunity about the utility, the worth of an endeavour that did not include the big players. But the treaty has been successful beyond expectations. Few nations today use or stockpile landmines, whereas their use in the past had been widespread and common. Since the treaty entered into force in 1999, the number of landmine-related deaths and injuries has dropped by over 60%, and that is meaningful. We are under no illusion that a treaty banning nuclear weapons will be a panacea. It will not magically transport us to a nuclear weapon-free world, but it will fundamentally change the game. It is the alternative to waiting in vain for US and Russian leadership. It is a way to translate into law the tenet propounded by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon that there are no right hands for wrong weapons. Through its normative force, a ban treaty would profoundly affect the behaviour even of states that refuse to join. The public, the media, parliamentarians and mayors would have a powerful new tool with which to challenge the possession of nuclear weapons by their governments. The ban would compel allies of nuclear-armed states to end the practice of hosting nuclear weapons on their soil and to reject the pretense of protection from a nuclear umbrella. It would oblige all states to divest from companies that manufacture nuclear arms. The Non-Proliferation Treaty falsely divides the world into nuclear weapon states and non-nuclear weapon states. In reality, there is a significant group in the middle, 30 or so nations that claim the protection of US nuclear weapons. They reinforce the idea of nuclear weapons as legitimate, useful, and necessary instruments. The humanitarian initiative has shone a spotlight on these enabler states, known less affectionately as weasel states, and they're scampering. They are not used to this level of scrutiny. They have always claimed to be committed to disarmament, but are clearly part of the problem, and that we can change. Many of these governments, it turns out, are vulnerable to public pressure. Take, for example, Japan, which, despite having experienced the horrors of nuclear war, maintains a policy of reliance on US nuclear weapons. In 2013, because of this policy, the Japanese government rejected an invitation by South Africa to sign on to a joint statement declaring that nuclear weapons should never be used again under any circumstances. ICAN protested against that decision. We organised a small spontaneous demonstration outside the Japanese mission in Geneva, and it made prime time news in Japan, prompting the foreign minister to convene a press conference to defend the decision, which in turn generated more furor. The mayor of Nagasaki, in his annual peace declaration, condemned Japan's stance as a betrayal of the expectations of the international community. And so Japan shifted its position. This is a small example of how we are winning. The joint statement itself was not an especially significant one, but the public's ability to influence the Japanese government's position so dramatically against its wishes was of enormous significance. And we'll see more of this in Japan and elsewhere as the process to achieve a treaty banning nuclear weapons progresses. Listening to the debates here 5 years ago about whether the US should ratify New START, I was struck by the comment of one senator that pursuing nuclear arms reductions is not America's decision alone, that America's allies too depend on US nuclear weapons and have a say, and that they want the arsenal to remain strong and large. The NATO allies and others were essentially being invoked as an excuse for maintaining the status quo. But what if that excuse no longer existed? What if they were on our side as states parties to a future treaty banning nuclear weapons? That, I expect, would have profound flow-on benefits for your work here in the United States to advance disarmament. The US government, interestingly, felt compelled to attend the Vienna conference in December, having boycotted the earlier conferences in Norway and Mexico, which it labelled a distraction from America's many other efforts to achieve nuclear disarmament. Why the change of heart? Does this mean that the US is now supportive of the initiative? Not at all. That was obvious in Vienna, but it is beside the point because the initiative does not depend on their endorsement. In a tone-deaf statement delivered immediately after the searing testimonies of survivors of America's nuclear atrocities in Japan and the Marshall Islands and its own backyard, the US ambassador declared that your country does not support and will oppose moves to ban nuclear weapons. He came across as callous, almost comically out of touch, a pariah in the room, not the mythical responsible nuclear power. That concept the humanitarian initiative has torn apart. The US attended Vienna for two reasons. It wanted to be seen as doing the right thing in the minds of its own citizens and before the international community, but also it wanted to stop the ban treaty proposal from gaining any further traction. The problem is that the momentum of this initiative is already considerable. The train has left the station and is gaining speed. Some states, of course, will get off along the way, and others will jump on board. The journey will be a rocky one, but we are confident that, before long, the train will reach its destination. I encourage you all to join in the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons, to work with us to put in place a global legal prohibition on the worst weapons ever created. This August marks 70 years since the US atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, an appropriate milestone one could not deny for the start of negotiations. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that. And also, I just wanted to mention that those of you in the US that want to get involved in ICAN, please feel free to contact me or Alice Slater. We'd be happy to talk to you about the campaign here, or also Greg Mello. The Los Alamos Study Group is one of our most active partner organizations here in the US. Our final speaker, she doesn't really need an introduction. I will say a few words anyway, but not too many, because I want to give her plenty of time to speak. Dr. Helen Caldicott is president of the Helen Caldicott Foundation. And she's devoted the last 42 years to an international campaign to educate the public about the global medical hazards of the nuclear age and the necessary changes in human behavior to stop environmental destruction. And her talk today is called While There's Life, There's Hope.
Thank you, Ray, and for being such a magnificent moderator. I also now want to thank Marley Lightfoot, my executive director, without whom none of this would have happened. She's magnificent. And I want to thank all the people who made presentations. I think it's been extremely educational and may change things a little. Now, the reason I organise this conference... Is there any water? I'm nervous and my mouth gets dry. The reason I organise this conference in the New York Academy of Medicine is obvious. I'm a doctor, a paediatrician and a physician. I decided at 11 I would become a doctor, although I was going to be a teacher before then, but I decided I could help more people being a doctor. And as a doctor, that is my total vocation. It's like being a nun or a priest. So I see this issue from a total medical perspective. If we have a nuclear war, we'll create the final epidemic, not just of the human race, but most of the 30 million other species that cohabit the planet with us. So, as a physician, what I do is I make a diagnosis. No, I don't make a diagnosis first. I take the history of the patient. And today and yesterday, we've had a very valid description and analysis of the history of the nuclear age with particular reference to the United States. Then I do a total physical examination, which I was trained to do. I undress the patient, I do a neurological examination, test the cranial nerves, listen to the chest, the heart, the abdomen, and the like. If I don't do that, I miss certain very important diseases or pathologies which were imperative to find. Doctors these days actually tend to practice computer medicine, which violates the Hippocratic Oath. Then we get into the pathology and the etiology. Etiology is the cause of a disease, and I've referred to this previously. We couldn't eliminate polio till we found the virus. There are many diseases now that were rampant when I was in medical school in 1956 that we can now control and often cure. So modern medicine has been magnificent in many respects, but we can't cure cancer. And I said previously, the medical dictum states if you have an incurable disease, we must prevent it. So what is the disease now infecting the planet? And who is or are responsible? Well, we've heard a lot about that today and yesterday. And there are many aspects and facets of the pathology which are so obvious to everyone. I've never really understood why men kill. When I was a little girl, I asked my father, but why do men rape women when they conquer a territory? Because the women have had nothing to do with it. He didn't know, and my father was a wonderful man. I think a lot about nationalism and tribalism and patriotism. I was here, I flew into Eau Claire, Wisconsin, the night before 9/11 happened. I woke up in the morning to see the planes going to the World Trade Towers. I was to give a lecture that night to several thousand students. And as I was walking across the campus to have a swim, one woman approached me and she said, "Do you believe in Jesus?" And I said, "No, I'm an atheist and I'm a pantheist." And she said, "You will go to hell." Like she psychologically hit me in the face. And I thought, this is a strange place. And it turned out that they were very Christian on that campus. So I thought, what am I going to say to these students tonight? And they filed in ashen face, just white face, shocked. And so I got out Luke and I read to them what Jesus said: "Love thine enemies and do good to those who hate you." And then I hoped and hoped that America would not seek vengeance. However, several days later, because the planes weren't flying except to deliver the family from Saudi Arabia back to Saudi Arabia, I had to take a Greyhound bus across the country. And every single... The country was swathed in flags, And every single mum and pop store said, God bless America. And I thought, oh my God, they're going to do it. So vengeance was the attitude, and it was clear that this country unites under that sort of stress and becomes like a tribe. And we know about tribalism, and we know that when we lived in caves as troglodytes, the men had to be strong and kill the saber-toothed tigers as we breastfed our babies in the caves, and we needed the men to be strong to kill the marauding tribes. However, that sort of psychology, mass psychology, is now obsolete. And it again goes back to what Einstein said. The splitting of the atom changed everything. The whole of reality, which we've witnessed today and yesterday, save man's mode of thinking. Thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. And I think listening to Jan Nolan and many others, we saw how the inner workings of Washington operate. I've been fascinated by the language of the military for years, who use such language as missile erectors, soft laydown, deep penetration. We'll have a nuclear war like one big orgasmic wump. And they talk like this in front of women with no sense of embarrassment at all or understanding of what they're actually on about. So does it come from the reptilian midbrain in these men, this desire to kill, and the bigger the bang, the better? Alice, who was the guy that designed the suitcase bomb? Ted Taylor designed the tiny little bomb that you could carry around in a suitcase, a hydrogen bomb. And I interviewed him on WBAI years ago, and he started talking. He was totally in favor of abolition. He felt terribly guilty. But as he started to describe the explosions, he got more and more excited. And I said, you really like explosions, don't you, Ted? And he said, yes. So what I think as physicians and all of us, we need to think of, we can count the number of bombs forever. We can count, look at the technology. We can look at the labs. We can look at the politicians. But we've got to understand the psyche. One in 25 people are sociopaths. They're brilliant, erudite, charming, but have no moral conscience. And I will write about this in my next book. But we've all known people like that, and you can point to people like that in your own government, or previously like Rumsfeld and Cheney, et al. We can't allow these people. And then I asked Robert Scheer to come, and I asked the wrong person because he didn't write Star Warriors, but there's a book describing the young men at the Lawrence Livermore Labs. They are aged 20 to 30. They have no relationships with anyone, including women. Many have Asperger's syndrome, but they're very brilliant, left brain, and they eat Coke and drink. They eat ice cream and drink Coke all day, and the only relationship they have is with their computer screen. These are the people in those labs often who are designing these weapons. And so instead of looking at the psyches of the people who are setting up our annihilation, we tend to look at the surface and look at the symptoms and do a physical examination, but not look at the etiology or the cause, and clearly the cause is psychological. And it's true, I think, that many men, and of course this is a generic problem, it's nothing to do with a man individually, they get terribly excited when war breaks out. I'll give you an example. I was sitting at a very posh social party in Palm Beach in Sydney when they were about to go into Iraq, the first Iraq, I think. And one person said, I think it was a man, she knows all about this. So they sat me in the middle of a circle, and I was surrounded by men who just absolutely went for me. And their wives were on the edge of the circle, but they turned their backs and I got no support from them, I suppose, because they thought they didn't want to fight with their husbands when they get home. But it was clear that these men had the scent of blood already in their nostrils. I also was invited to Barclays Bank to talk to the bankers about this, and they almost forced me off the stage. I nearly walked off. They were so incredibly rude. So there's something much deeper than the analysis that we've produced over the last 2 days, and that's what I want to address in my next book, Why Men Kill and Why Women Let Them. And I won't go into this except to say much recent work has been done on hormonal receptors in the brain and the influence of behaviour. It's really quite fascinating from a physiological perspective. But then there are women. 52% or 53% of the population of the world are women. We have oxytocin, estrogen, progesterone. We're built to nurture. And we've got no guts. And people say, well, look at Thatcher and look at Hillary Clinton and others. But it's very interesting because when women are in a community with men, say like Congress, if they're present in less than 30%, they tend to vote with the men. Above 30% representation, they will say, no, we're not voting for missiles today. We're voting for milk for children. And it has nothing to do with politics at all. It's where we kind of live. So often after a speech, I'll be surrounded by people and a man will give an idea. And I say, that's great. You should run for Congress. He'll stick his chest out and say, yeah. A woman will give a similarly good idea. And I'll say, you should run for Congress. She literally takes 2 steps back and says, who, me? And so if you look at history, you look around this building, what are the statues of, except for the skeletons, which I love, and the pictures and stuff, they're all men. And we, throughout history, have played little role. Now, unless we move to the plate, stand up for our children and future generations, I don't think we're going to survive. This is not a sexist discussion at all. I'm looking at etiology and the psyches of the leaders and the people who are doing this. Now, the treatment. I learned from the 80s that, well, I was asked to write an article for the New England Journal of Medicine on nuclear power. I got a lot of articles and did a lot of research. And I happened to publish a full-page ad in the New England Journal about nuclear power and the medical dangers the day after Three Mile Island happened. Thus began Physicians for Social Responsibility. And we recruited 23,000 doctors, and I started medical organisations all over the world. And I had a wonderful agent in Hollywood who worked for me for free, who put me on television with film stars, because who wants to hear a boring woman doctor talking about nuclear war, because people wouldn't buy, you know, their hemorrhoid cream or whatever they have to buy by watching television. And so I got a lot of exposure. She got me in Vogue and Life and Time. You can't imagine. And I'd go up to an aeroplane desk and book in, and the man would say, I saw you on 60 Minutes last night. You're right. And so by massive media exposure and education by the doctors, because we're totally credible, all politicians have to have a doctor. So it doesn't matter about their politics, we are there and we're actually conservatives because we're for conserving life. So through education, in 5 years, from most Americans saying it's better to be dead than red, in 5 years, 80% of Americans supported the concept to the end of the nuclear arms race. So we had it. We mobilised and organised it through education. So I go back to President Jefferson, who said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. This issue is a medical issue. It's a medical issue. And if put that way, it breaks down the barriers of people who say, oh, you're communist or you're whatever. It's got nothing to do with that. It's medical. Will we survive or will we not? Will we create the final epidemic or will we not? So now I played on the beach for you yesterday so you would feel in your soul what it means for everyone to die. And I was brought up in Melbourne where that film was set. And I read that when I was 16, and that marked my soul, and I was never the same again. And that's why I do the work I do, because I can feel it and see it, what could happen. So therefore, what I'm going to say to you is, there's a syndrome in Australia called aorta. It's not the main vessel coming out of the heart. It's aorta fix the bridges, aorta fix the politicians, aorta do this. Now, the aorta syndrome is inappropriate. The only person you can change is yourself. You can influence nobody else, but you can change yourself. You can educate yourself, and you've been well educated these last 2 days. Go through the grief, if you have it, of shock and disbelief, which I'm sure some of you are feeling, and grief and depression. Let yourself be depressed. Let yourself go through the feeling, because the next phase is anger. And anger, when focused in a white-hot beam, is extraordinarily important. It's why we have an adrenal medulla that pumps out adrenaline when we're chased by a bull. It's fight or flight. And we can use our anger, which gives us tremendous power, to do the right thing. And if a door's closed in front of you, you go in the back door. You always go to the top. I used to go and see Tip O'Neill on the house floor. So what I'm saying is, if you change and go through grief, and you'll know what to do. You know, there are people here who are publishers, who are writers, and all sorts of things. You've got special talents. You will know what to do. And if you speak your truth and you do what you are impelled to do, you will become a leader, because people like that. So often people say, "You're so courageous." I'm not courageous. I'm just a doctor telling the truth. Doctors have to tell the truth, which is very unpleasant often, to their patients and help them through their grief. So I'm not courageous at all. There's a sense of conformity in this society. Everyone has straight teeth. When I go to Germany, I get a bit shocked because they all have pretty crooked teeth. Everyone says, "Have a nice day," and I don't even want to have a nice day, let alone be told to have a nice day or thank you for calling AT&T when I didn't want to call AT&T in the first place. So conformity is death, eccentricity is life, and the spice of a society. And you can become an eccentric by becoming who you really are and what you are born to do. We were born, this generation, we were born to save the creation that's taken billions and billions and billions and billions of years to evolve. That's why we're here. You can be as the most powerful person who ever lived. And I've kind of done that. If I can do it, I'm an alien, a woman, just a doctor. You can do it too. So there are enough people right here or who are listening, if they decide within their own soul and go through the stages I've just described, we'll save the planet. And fundamentally, it boils down to love. If I tell parents their child has leukemia, they will sell their house, they will go to the Mayo Clinic, they will do whatever it takes to save that beloved child's life. And if the child dies, they'll never recover. So I would say, how much do you love your children? How much do you love your grandchildren? How much do you love the lilacs when they flower in the spring and the wisteria? This is about love, not just for your children, but for your own life. We were born to save the planet, and we can do it if you love this planet. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that beautiful speech. And we don't have a Q&A after this session because we wanted to give Dr. Caldicott the final word, which she definitely had on love. So thank you very much to everybody for coming to the conference and participating the past 2 days. And we look forward to seeing you all helping us ban nuclear weapons in the next year.